That's right. It's Conversation Out Loud, or Think Conversation. We haven't figured out that yet. But we're live in Oregon, Southwest Washington, and the Puget Sound region.
On the show today, we're going to hear about a controversial new hire in Vancouver, the 8-person Seattle mayor's race, which is heating up. We'll also ask if centrism has a future in the Northwest.
And in the second half, the Portland-Seattle smackdown. Which city reigns supreme, Portland or Oregon? In Oregon or Seattle in Washington? And the conversation is already heating up on Twitter. Hashtag PDXVSEA.
Let's start with some news, though. When you think protests in Seattle, you might think WTO or the recent May Day protests. But another group of protesters is making waves in the Emerald City. This past winter, teachers at Garfield High School in Seattle refused to administer the mandatory measure of academic progress test known as the MAP. Teachers at 7 different Seattle schools have joined the boycott. KUOW's Phyllis Fletcher joins us from the studio in Seattle for more. Phyllis, good to have you on.
Thank you.
So for our Oregon listeners who may not be aware of it, what is the MAP test?
It's a test the Seattle School District gives 2 or 3 times a year. The idea is you look at the first test and the second and then possibly third, and it tells you something about what students are learning or not learning.
So why are these teachers, these groups of teachers in different schools now, boycotting a test?
Lots of reasons. They say it doesn't intersect with standards they're already teaching to that are mandated by the Seattle School District and the state of Washington. They also say that, especially for older students, they know it does not affect their grades, so they don't necessarily take it seriously. So because of all those factors, the teachers say the test doesn't serve its stated purpose, which is to give useful data about how students are progressing. So it's basically, they say, a big mess they have to make time for every year, and they're sick of it.
How much support do these teachers have from their schools?
Well, it depends how you define school. If you define school by students and parents, the support is substantial. A lot of parents signed off on things that let their children opt out of the tests. So by the parent and teacher definition of school and student definition, they have a lot of support.
So, but that's one definition. What about in terms of official discipline? Have teachers or schools or administrators been disciplined for not giving this test, which is mandatory?
No, that was threatened early on, and it was rolled back.
So this week, after about 3 months, a MAP task force released its preliminary recommendations to be finalized next week. What did this task force say?
Well, I read in the Seattle Times that the recommendation is to keep the test for K through 8 schools, so that's kindergarten through 8th grade, and let high schools off the hook.
So if they're recommending getting rid of mandatory testing for high schoolers, why not also get rid of it for K through 8? Why the difference here?
Well, what I can say about that is that the summary I've seen of the recommendations focus on how useful or not the test is. And so based on what's been said about the test before, I would imagine that the majority opinion of the task force was that it still has some educational benefit for younger kids. But I'm eager to see the details on that.
Is this being seen as a win for these teacher activists?
May I put on my pundit hat?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. So I would guess teachers see this as a big win today. The epic win, though, would be if the superintendent decides to not renew the contract with the company that makes this test. That would just end the whole thing.
So what are the next steps here? We were talking about these are sort of the preliminary recommendations that were released this week. What happens next?
The next thing to happen is the superintendent, Jose Banda, officially gets the full report from this task force on Monday.
So, you know, we're talking about the MAPS test, but as I understand it, not just Washington, but many other states, most other states across the country, including Oregon, are moving towards a common core set of standards, which may have their own set of tests. How much longer might we be talking about MAPS anyway?
Well, I guess we'd be talking about some measurement of how students progress for, you know, decades. I think that discussion is being well rolled out and well entrenched. And that happens, the Common Core is something that this company that makes the MAP test supports. But as far as this test being given in Seattle public schools, with my pundit hat still on, I say its days maybe are numbered.
Phyllis, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
That's Phyllis
Dave
Fletcher.
Miller. And that's Dave Miller.
Yes, Roz. I was going to tell people who she is. Phyllis Fletcher, the education editor at KUOW.
Dave Miller is in Portland. I'm in Seattle. You're listening to a simulcast of Think Out Loud and The Conversation. What led to Washington conservation voters, asking their members in an email yesterday, is this a joke? Well, it was the same dispute that led one Southwest Washington politician to storm out of a meeting this week, spewing profanity behind him. Clark County, Washington has historically been one of the most politically mixed in the state, but what would seem like a routine administrative hire has set off a firestorm. OPB reporter April Baer joins us now to unpack the story. April, what's going on?
Well, Ross, it's like you say, under normal circumstances, the actual thing itself might seem a minor bureaucratic story, but with the state's biggest transportation project, the Columbia River crossing, in the background, politics in Clark County have been anything but usual, you might say. What happened was that two of Clark County's three county commissioners made a surprise move on Wednesday to hire a new director of environmental services, and their choice was State Senator Don Benton.
And why was Don Benton such a controversial choice for this? We know him as a conservative state senator. We know he's been opposed to the Columbia River crossing. And for those of our listeners who might not be familiar with it, that's the bridge they're talking about building between Washington and Oregon. The Oregon legislature has approved it. So far, the Washington legislature has not done it. Why is this such a big deal?
Right. Well, the Columbia River crossing, or CRC, has figured really very largely in regional politics for quite a while now. Part of the reason why Benton was a non-conventional choice here is who's doing the hiring. David Medor was elected to the county commission last year. He's more conservative than his predecessor, and he and another commissioner have voted together on a couple of key issues, giving the county's political climate a decidedly more conservative bent recently. The other thing that's unusual here is that Clark County's typical practice would be to post the job, hold some interviews, and pick a candidate. The commissioners do have the power to vote and appoint a bureau chief, but usually they direct a hiring process with a committee and candidates, and they didn't do that this time.
So what is Don Benton's background to become a leader in this position in Clark County on the environment? What does he bring to it?
Well, you may remember he's been in the legislature for about 16 years now. His professional background is as a sales and marketing consultant. He's got some insurance business background. He actually chairs a financial institutions housing and insurance committee in the legislature on the Senate side. His resume is thin on environmental qualifications, and that's what got so much attention here. The Environmental Services Agency in Clark County handles stormwater, noxious weeds, and here's the key thing, permitting for projects that might have an effect on the environment. Benton also has a somewhat troubled history with the Washington Republican Party. He was party chair for a while and fell afoul of the board and left after less than a year. But again, most people really know him as a bridge opponent. And the questions that people are raising is, why is this guy a candidate for environmental services? Now, David Medor, one of the commissioners who voted for him, says that he was really picked for his leadership qualities.
Now, what kind of reaction is this hire getting? Not positive, I gather.
Well, you might say the biggest reaction was from Clark County Commissioner Steve Stewart. He was the dissenting voice on the vote. When he realized what his colleagues were proposing on Wednesday, he blew up and left the room. And there was a reporter with the Columbia newspaper there who caught the whole thing in a recording. I'm going to play just a taste of it for you.
I can't even believe you guys are discussing that. That's disgusting. I'm done for the day. I'm so sick. You do your thing.
Been there, done that.
So that was what Steve Stewart had to say. It's not too strong a statement to say that the environmental community has been pretty close to hitting the roof on this one. Like I said, the Washington conservation voters sent out a fundraising email about this saying, we can do better. Tell the commissioners that they need to appoint someone who has experience in environmental permitting. And one member of the county's Clean Water Commission, which interacts with environmental services, has resigned in protest. And since this is 2013, there's a meme. The satiric website Daily Couve, which it must be said leans a bit left, has been posting a popular picture of Benton with captions on his status as, quoting here, the most qualified man in the county.
Okay. Well, some laughs and certainly some political fundraising going on. But is there anything these opponents can do about this? It's pretty much the discretion of the commissioners to appoint this position, isn't it?
That's absolutely true. And that's what Benton's defenders, have to say is that, the whole point from their perspective is that they would like to see someone in the position who can expedite the permitting process and, cut through bureaucracy. David Medor said to me yesterday that, a dead fish can float downstream, but that he considered Don Benton a live fish who would, swim upstream and do what Medor said is right, even if it's not popular. He also said that Benton's experience opposing the Columbia River crossing was relevant. The Twitter and the comments sections on these stories have been very busy, but it may be that this is one of those things where the voters might decide to, you know, just take it into consideration when elections come along. You know, some have suggested let Benton have the job, see what he does, and you know there's a time and a place for assessing how public officials and their appointees are doing. So, but for now, it appears that he's accepted the job and will be starting.
Thanks, April.
Glad to be here.
Oregon Public Broadcasting's April Baer. You're listening to a special simulcast between KUOW and Oregon Public Broadcasting. Think out loud in the conversation together. Up ahead, Oregon Republicans recalibrate in the wake of electoral loss. Portland Smackdown. Which city rules? Which city drools? It's already raging on Twitter. Hashtag PDXVSEA. That's when our KUOW Oregon Public Broadcasting simulcast continues.
...63 degrees in Seattle, mostly sunny, expecting sun all day with a high of 72.
Support for KUOW comes from STG, presenting the National Theatre of Scotland's production of Black Watch, the international play based on Gregory Burke's interviews with Iraq war soldiers from the Scottish Regiment. Now through May 5th at the Paramount Theatre. Tickets at stgpresents.org.
It's 12:18. The National Rifle Association's annual meeting began today in Houston. We'll find out what's going on there in 40 minutes on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
You're listening to a joint broadcast of Think Out Loud and The Conversation. I'm Dave Miller in Portland.
I'm Ross Reynolds in Seattle. We're not going to hear from a couple of editors about some of the major news coming out of our two regions.
Knut Berger is editor-at-large and a columnist for Seattle Magazine. He also writes for Crosscut.com.
And Mark Zussman is editor at the Willamette Week. Mark, last week the Seattle-Portland City Council voted to fluoridate the city's water. This was last fall. And on May 21st, Portland voters are going to get a chance whether to uphold this decision or turn it down. Pro-fluoride groups like the American Medical Association and the National Institutes of Health say there's no safety risk. They argue that fluoride helps prevent cavities for low-income children with no access to dental care. Opponents are questioning the health benefits, and some, as I understand, like the Sierra Club, worry about the environmental impacts. Mark Zussman, debates over fluoridation sound so 1980s. Why is this such a controversial issue in Portland?
Well, as you know, Portland is the largest major metropolitan area that does not have fluoride in its water. There have been, I believe, three attempts over the past 60 or so years to do so. None have succeeded. And Mayor Sam Adams and Randy Leonard, who both are no longer on the city council before they departed, led an effort to get city council to vote to put fluoride in our water, and opponents got enough signatures, put it on the ballot, and we are in the midst of a very heated, very close, and passion-filled campaign.
What's the history of fluoride in the city? Never been fluoridation?
Never.
And what's the tone of the debate? You say it's heated, a lot of trash talk back and forth?
We've had reporters who've been attending debates, which are packed beyond the fire marshal capacity, pretty atypical for a civic debate. We had the opponents and proponents in our office for the editorial endorsement, and they were screaming at each other by the end. Passions really are high. I think part of it is that the opponents of fluoride feel that the city tried to pull a fast one on them. But I think it's also because for a variety of reasons, this is an issue that particularly on the no side really stirs a lot of passions, a lot of fears, and I would argue perhaps a little bit more heat than light.
There's a couple of levels to this. There's the substance of fluoride scientifically, but there's also just how this issue got on the ballot. Why has that become a bone of contention?
Well, it became a bone of contention because the city rammed it through the city council, and then enough signatures were gathered to have an election that would have been held in 2014. And city council sort of changed the rules and moved the election up until this month. Opponents thought it was an attempt to sort of dictate the outcome of the election by shortening the time at which there could be healthy civic debate.
And what about the substantive criticisms about fluoride? What are you hearing?
Well, I mean, please understand that our paper this week came out and endorsed the notion of putting fluoride in the water. So perhaps I'm not objective at this point. We've taken a look at all the science. There's overwhelming scientific consensus that fluoride reduces the incidence of cavities and that the health risks are negligible, particularly at the parts per million that fluoride will be added to the water. That said, in the same way that there are those who, despite the overwhelming scientific consensus, believe that there is no such thing as global warming, there are those who believe that fluoride is unhealthy.
And I also see that some of the opponents of this say that already Portlanders have fewer cavities than the nation at large and seem to be asking, well, why do we need fluoride?
We've taken a look at those studies and they just don't stand up. If I can make one other observation, you know, as you pointed out, this feels like the 80s or the 50s. I mean, the fluoride has been a divisive issue in this country for a long time. Early in its history, the opposition came from the far right wing. Matter of fact, the John Birch Society made a great deal of hay opposing fluoride. Well, there's really no far right wing in Portland. The opposition in Portland and recently in the last 10 years elsewhere in the country, Santa Cruz is a good example, has come from the very left, from people who are very, very environmentally oriented and who simply don't want chemicals added to their water.
How do you think this vote is going to go, Mark Sussman? It comes up May 21st. Any polling done? Any indication?
There are polls being done by the campaigns that aren't public. I am privy to one of them, which shows that the yes on fluoride is up, but by less than 6 to 8 points. That's awfully close, and this will be a low turnout election. And I think that those who are opposed to this measure are probably more motivated than those who are in support of it. So I would not bet either way.
Knute Burgess with us, too, with Seattle Magazine. It sounds like a distant debate to us, but this has been a debate in the past, Knute.
Well, it has. As Mark pointed out, it was kind of a flat earth issue back in the 50s and 60s. Now it's become sort of a hippie issue. And I say that as somebody who's often called a hippie. In Bellingham, for example, Seattle's water is fluoridated, but Bellingham had a vote in 2005. They defeated the attempt to put fluoride in the water up there. And it was also a close vote, I think 53-47, something like that, to turn it down.
I'm Ross Reynolds, and this is The Conversation in Seattle.
And this is Think Out Loud on Oregon Public Broadcasting. I'm Dave Miller in Portland. We're doing a co-production combining forces to bring you perspectives from both states today. We're going to turn to some mayoral politics now. The most recent mayoral election here in Portland was this past November. Former City Commissioner Charlie Hales won. He took office in January. Since then, he's been dealing with what is at least a $20 million budget shortfall. Just this week, he released his proposed budget, which calls for cutting 170 city jobs. Mark, what stood out to you in the proposed budget from Charlie Hales, his first?
Well, a couple of things. Mayor Hales is a solid Democrat. He said now is not the time to raise taxes, and instead he cut the budget pretty seriously, including two departments which are oftentimes viewed as sacred cows, one, the Fire Bureau, and two, the Police Bureau, where he would be reducing actually the number of people who are employed there. That's not something that happens very often in Portland. And in fact, yesterday he announced that he wants to – he didn't use the word bust, but in essence he wants to bust the union that represents commanders in the police department.
You know, this gets to some echoes, potential questions of centrism, which we're going to be taking up in just a few minutes. But I want to move on to Seattle mayoral politics with Knute Berger. In Seattle, the 2013 mayor's race is heating up. The primary is in August. The general election is in November. There are 8 candidates right now. One of them is the incumbent mayor, Mike McGinn. Knute, for people in Oregon who might not be familiar with Mayor McGinn, give us an introduction.
Well, Mike McGinn was an insurgent candidate, a dark horse. He ran against in the primary 4 years ago against the incumbent, Greg Nickels. popular Democrat, and Nichols was defeated in the primary because, well, for a lot of reasons, but one is Seattle voters tend to be fickle. The other was a kind of a semi-scandal involving the how the mayor had dealt with cleaning up after a snowstorm. Anyway, Mike McGinn is a green, a bike advocate. He bikes to work. Is proud of it. He's got a beard. He could be mayor of Portland the way the way he looks.
Yeah.
But he's also very pro development. But he got off to a rough start. He was a rookie in politics. He opposed a major downtown tunnel project and kind of flip flopped on that issue. And of course, we've had hard economic times, a lot of budget cutting. So he's had to deal with some real issues. The city now is rebounding economically. The cranes are back. High rises are going up. Looks like we're looking at some budget surpluses coming up. But the political opponents were viewing McGinn as a weakened incumbent. And there, so a bunch of them jumped in. They were treating it almost like it was an open seat.
So with these fickle Seattle voters you're talking about, who are the leading challengers right now?
Well, there are two members of the city council, Tim Burgess and Bruce Harrell, who are opposing McGinn. Peter Steinbrück, whose father, Victor Steinbrück, was famous for saving the Pike Place Market in Pioneer Square. He's a former city council member also. He's running in the race. We have State Senator Ed Murray, who was the majority leader in the Senate up until recently when there was a mini coup in Olympia. And then there a variety of other candidates have jumped in the race. The interesting thing is that none of the major candidates in the race are women. There are two women running, both named Martin, not related. But they're kind of dark horse candidates.
So those are some of the people who've already thrown their hats into the rings. What issues do you think are going to be coming to the fore?
Well, there are a number of issues. One of the big issues is police accountability, and this is maybe an area where there's something in common. The Justice Department came in and ordered oversight of the police department because of its use of force policies and issues relating to the culture of policing.
Something that sounds very familiar to Portland listeners.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's both the process of setting up the oversight process turned very contentious between the city attorney and the mayor. There's also union negotiations going on with the police guild, which is right in the thick of this. So public safety is one of the major issues. The other issue is McGinn himself. The candidates, Seattle's a Democratic city. All the candidates are Democrats except for one from the Socialist Workers Party. So it's kind of shades of left. But McGinn's leadership style is one of the big issues. Seattle is a town where people are used to having a sort of consensus and listening to everybody. McGinn has brought a kind of lawyerly style. And so the critique that is coming from the other candidates is really about McGinn's style of leadership, whether it's effective.
If you're just tuning in, this is a co-production of Think Out Loud from Oregon Public Broadcasting and The Conversation from KUOW. Knut, we had you on the show in March after former Washington Governor Booth Gardner died. It happened to be right around the time of the 100th birthday of the late Oregon Governor Tom McCall. We talked about the legacy of both executives, and you ended up writing about the two as models of a certain kind of political centrism from the Northwest. You wrote, "The Northwest has often liked Democrats who act like Republicans and Republicans who act like Democrats." What do you mean?
Well, part of it's the reality of part of it's the reality of winning statewide. Seattle mayors, Seattle being a Seattle mayor is kind of a dead end, partly because the city is insular and compared to the rest of the state. So we tend to pick governors who are conservative Democrats who can get votes in suburban and rural areas. This was also true of Republicans once upon a time who we actually had urban Republicans at one point from Seattle and elsewhere. And they were able to win with moderate policies. And we always look to people in Oregon like Tom McCall and Senator Hatfield and what as sort of kindred spirits of a kind of Northwest politician that was not a slave to party dogma. And now that's changing. We're living in times where things are much more partisan. But I think there's still continues to be a kind of yearning for people who put getting things done ahead of strict party politics.
But it seems that centrism is a moving target. There are no fixed positions, really. There are some, but conservatism and liberalism or progressive politics, they move around a little bit. So what does centrism mean to you right now?
Well, they do. One of the areas that you're seeing a lot of consensus on, which I find fascinating, Seattle only had one – there was only one precinct in all of Seattle that went for Mitt Romney in the last election, and it's a gated community called Broadmoor. And but Broadmoor also voted for gay marriage and pot legalization. And I think there's this really interesting area on social issues in particular of a kind of new center of where the majority of people are. The fiscal issues are the areas where we tend to have the most debate, that tax or no tax. That's not really a debate in urban Pugetopolis, but it is a big debate in other parts of the state.
I'm Ross Reynolds, and you're listening to a joint broadcast of Oregon Public Broadcasting and KUOW. Dave Miller's in Portland. I'm here. Let's turn the conversation on centrism to statewide in Oregon. Mark Zussman, editor at the Willamette Week, is with us. Oregon hasn't seen a Republican in statewide office for over 10 years, Mark, and it's been a Democrat for governor and Democratic majorities in both the House and the Senate. Doesn't sound like much hope of centrism there.
Well, on the one hand, you're right, Ross, although I think that has more to do with a certain amount of dysfunction within the Republican Party infrastructure. And on the other hand, I guess I would disagree with you. I think the current governor, John Kitzhaber, with one exception, actually does manage and run from the center. Right now, one of his big issues in the legislature is he's trying to bring about pretty serious pension reform for public employees, not an issue that typically most Democrats take up. Ron Wyden, senior senator from Oregon, really is a centrist. I mean, if you recall, he signed on to do some health care reform with Paul Ryan, of all people. And again, in City Hall, I think Charlie Hills, a solid Democrat, is nevertheless sort of managing from the middle. So I'm not sure that's entirely an accurate representation.
Last year in Washington, there was a lot of excitement among moderate Republicans that Rob McKenna, the attorney general, might win. He lost. And I understand you had a very similar situation in your Secretary of State race.
Well, again, the Secretary of State race was against an incumbent, a very well-entrenched Democrat, and a complete political newcomer who was a physician. And simply actually came fairly close to beating her, and I think gave her a good scare. Again, I'm not sure that's a good test of the kitchen. Perhaps a better one is in the governor's race, where John Kitzhaber, who had been governor twice, came very close, won, but almost lost to a former basketball player, Chris Dudley, who was a moderate Republican who had no political experience and came close to beating him. So I do think that there's an opportunity for a Republican to get elected. That, of course, assumes that Republican is pro-choice. I think that's one of those issues that a Republican has got to cross the aisle on.
Do any figures jump out at you as moderate Republicans who might have a good future in Oregon politics?
You know, it's amazing. Jeff Merkley, who's the junior senator from Oregon, who's coming up for reelection. And, you know, as I'm sure that you know, the best time to beat an incumbent is at his first reelection. I've been told that the Republican Senatorial Campaign Committee in D.C. has a $10 million check to write to any legitimate candidate who can run against Merkley. There doesn't appear to be anybody in Oregon of a stature. So there's just very little in the way of a bench. Really, the only person is Greg Walden, who is the only Republican congressman. He doesn't show any inclination to come back to Oregon and run statewide. He's doing very well in Congress.
Mark Zussman, editor at Willamette Week. Knute Berger writes for the online magazine Crosscut and is a weekly guest here at KUOW. His books include Pugetopolis, A Mossback Takes on Growth Addicts.